A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's parenting an 11-month-old with his wife, no family nearby, no daycare, barely any babysitting, and he's finding that the context switching is destroying his ability to do deep work. He's treated on Vyvanse, mental health is solid, but the practical reality is that his brain gets pulled to another task, and he can't pick up where he left off. He's asking for techniques. Pragmatic, organizational, systems-level techniques, not therapy. And he specifically wants to know who even provides that kind of help, because general therapists keep treating the stress as psychological when the root problem is structural. I think this is one of those questions where the framing itself is half the insight.
It really is. And the first thing I want to name is that what he's describing isn't just context switching, it's the cost of re-entry after interruption. Those are two different things. Voluntary context switching, where you finish a task, stand up, get coffee, and deliberately move to the next thing. That's manageable. What he's living with is involuntary interruption-driven fragmentation, where your attention is yanked mid-thought. And for an ADHD brain, that distinction is everything.
Because when you choose the switch, your brain has time to save its state. When the baby cries, there's no save point.
There's a study from the University of California, Irvine. This was Gloria Mark's lab, 2005, and it's been replicated since. They found that after an interruption, it takes an average of 23 minutes and 15 seconds for a neurotypical person to return to the original task. And that's not just 23 minutes of doing other things. That's 23 minutes of fragmented attention, partial re-engagement, false starts. For ADHD brains, the estimated resumption cost is 40 to 60% higher. So we're talking 35, 40 minutes to fully reload your mental state after a 2-minute interruption.
If you're getting interrupted every 45 minutes, which with an 11-month-old is optimistic, you literally never reach full re-engagement. You're perpetually in the loading screen.
The loading screen is the perfect metaphor. And what's happening neurologically is something called task set reconfiguration. When you're doing deep work, your brain has assembled a specific attentional frame. It knows what's relevant, what to suppress, what the next three moves are. An interruption shatters that frame. Rebuilding it requires dopamine in the prefrontal cortex, and ADHD brains have baseline dopamine dysregulation. So every re-entry is more expensive, not because you're not trying hard enough, but because the neurochemical cost is structurally higher.
This is where I think the listener's frustration with therapy-first approaches comes in. You can't therapize your way out of dopamine depletion during re-entry. That's like trying to talk therapy your way out of a broken leg.
And I want to be careful here. Therapy has its place, and for many people with IDIHD, the emotional layers are real. Shame, frustration, the feeling of constantly letting people down. But the listener is saying something specific. The organizational challenges are causing the downstream psychological stress, not the other way around. Treat the structure first. If you fix the re-entry cost, a lot of the overwhelm resolves, because the overwhelm was a rational response to an impossible situation.
Let's start with what's actually happening in those 23 to 40 minutes. You said task set reconfiguration. Break that down for me. What are the actual components of where was I?
First, you have to remember where you were. Literally, what was the last thing you typed? What file was open? What line of thought were you in? Second, you have to remember what you were about to do next, the intention that was forming right before the interruption hit. And third, you have to rebuild the attentional frame, the filter that tells your brain, this is relevant, that's noise. Each of those is a separate cognitive operation, and each one requires working memory. ADHD brains have working memory deficits. So you're trying to hold three fragile things in a system that's already bad at holding things.
The cruel part is, the more deeply you are engaged, the more state there is to lose. If you were surface-level answering emails, the re-entry cost is trivial. If you were three layers deep in a complex problem, the entire mental model collapses.
That's why the listener's coworkers describe him as someone who produces prodigious work in concentrated blocks. He's a deep work specialist, and deep work is the most expensive kind of mental state to rebuild after interruption. It's like the difference between losing your place in a magazine article versus losing your place in a dense technical specification while you're mid-architecture decision.
We've established the problem is real, measurable, and structural. Let's talk about the engineering approach. You mentioned something in our prep about a state file metaphor, like how programmers save context before a context switch.
In programming, when you're working on a feature and something urgent comes up, you run git stash. That saves your current changes, not as a finished commit, just as a snapshot of exactly where you were. So you can switch to the urgent thing, then come back and restore your state exactly. Most knowledge workers don't have a git stash for their brain, and IDIHD brains need one desperately, because we can't trust working memory to hold that state.
What does a brain git stash look like in practice?
The simplest version is what I call an externalized state file. Before you stand up from your desk, or ideally, the moment you sense an interruption coming, you capture three things: where you are, what you are about to do, and what the next action is. This can be a sticky note, a voice memo, a text file. The format matters less than the consistency. I know a software engineer parent who tapes a 3x5 card to their monitor. Left side says where I was, could be line 412 of auth module, refactoring the token validation. Right side says next three things. 1. Finish the error handling branch. 2. Write the unit test. 3. Merge to dev. When they come back after dealing with the baby, they don't have to remember any of it. They just read the card.
Because it offloads the most expensive part of re-entry, the remembering, onto an external artifact. You're not using your brain to store the state. You're using your brain to read the state.
There's good research behind this. A 2022 study in the Journal of Attention Disorders found that ADHD adults who used external memory aids, notes, alarms, voice memos, reduced task switching errors by 34% compared to those who relied on internal memory alone. 34%. That's not marginal. That's the difference between spending your workday in a fog of partial engagement and actually finishing things.
This also leverages something called the Zeigarnik effect, the tendency to remember interrupted tasks better than completed ones. The brain keeps pinging you about unfinished business. But if you write down exactly where you left off, the Zeigarnik tension releases. Your brain goes, okay, it's captured. I can let go.
The act of externalizing tells your brain the task is handled. Not completed, but handled. The information is safe. You can stop the background loop of, don't forget, don't forget, don't forget.
Which, for someone with ADHD, that background loop is consuming dopamine the entire time it's running. So you're not just saving the state, you're stopping the resource leak.
Now let's talk about the second piece, which is time architecture. The listener said he doesn't have concentrated blocks anymore. And the standard advice, block off 4 hours of deep work, is useless for a parent with an 11-month-old. But the alternative isn't giving up on deep work. It's redesigning the blocks.
I've seen the Pomodoro technique suggested for this, 25-minute sprints. But I've always found that frustrating. By the time I'm actually deep into something, the timer goes off.
Pomodoro fails for ADHD deep work for exactly that reason. 25 minutes is long enough to load the mental state, but not long enough to use it. What works better is a 45-minute sprint with a 15-minute re-entry buffer. The 45 minutes is your actual work window, long enough to make meaningful progress. The 15-minute buffer is not a break. It's insurance. It absorbs the resumption cost if you get interrupted. And if you don't get interrupted, you roll that buffer into the next sprint or use it for low cognitive tasks.
You're not scheduling 4 hours of work. You're scheduling 3 45-minute sprints across the day, each with a buffer, and you treat those sprints as sacred.
You align them with your medication window. The listener mentioned he's on Vyvanse. Vyvanse has a characteristic plasma concentration curve. It peaks around 3 to 4 hours after dosing, and the effective window for most people is about 8 to 10 hours, but the peak focus period is narrower than that. If you know your peak window, say 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., you put your highest value 45-minute sprints in that zone. You don't try to stretch coverage across the whole day. You concentrate firepower.
That's a military metaphor that actually works. You're not trying to hold the entire front. You're identifying the two or three engagements that actually matter, and bringing everything to those.
The rest of the day, you do what I call low-state work. Reading that doesn't require deep comprehension. Tasks where interruption doesn't cost you much because there's not much state to lose.
We've got the state file for capturing where you are, and we've got time box sprints aligned with medication. But there's a third piece here that I think is crucial, which is the interruption itself. The listener can't control when the baby needs attention, but can he control how the interruption happens?
This is where an interruption protocol comes in. The idea is to pre-agree with your partner on signal levels for different interruption severities. Green means, I'm in shallow work, interrupt freely. Yellow means, I'm in a sprint, interrupt only if genuinely urgent. Red means, I'm in the final 10 minutes of a sprint and trying to land the plane, interrupt only for blood or fire.
The key word there is pre-agree. You're not negotiating this in the moment while stressed and interrupted. The contract exists before the crisis.
And it has to go both ways. When your partner is in a yellow or red window, you respect it too. This isn't about one person's work being more important. It's about both people acknowledging the fragmentation has a real cost and trying to batch interruptions where possible.
There's also something here about context anchoring. Using sensory cues to signal, I am now in deep work mode, even when the window is short. Because one of the problems with fragmented time is that your brain never gets the signal that it's time to focus.
Yes, and this is where you can hack your environment to do some of the work for you. Pick a specific playlist that you only play during sprints. Not background music you always have on. A specific album or playlist that your brain associates exclusively with deep work. Change the lighting. A desk lamp angled differently, a specific color temperature. Even something as simple as moving your chair to a different position. These are what I call context anchors. They're external triggers that tell your brain this is the mode now, and they work because IDIHD brains are highly cue dependent.
It's basically Pavlovian conditioning for your own prefrontal cortex.
I wouldn't have put it that way, but yes, and it works surprisingly fast. After about 2 weeks of consistent pairing, this playlist equals this mental state. The playlist alone starts to trigger the attentional shift. You're borrowing your brain's association machinery to shortcut the reentry process.
Let's talk about the interruption taxonomy for a moment, because I think not all interruptions are created equal. The baby crying is one category, but there's also internal drift. You're working and suddenly you realize you've been researching something completely unrelated for 15 minutes.
External interruptions. Baby, partner, phone, doorbell, and internal interruptions. Task drift, hyperfocus collapse, the sudden conviction that you need to reorganize your entire file system right now. External interruptions are harder for ADHD brains in a specific way. They violate what I call the dopamine contract. You were engaged, you were getting the neurochemical reward of progress, and then it's ripped away. Your brain doesn't just lose the state, it experiences a miniature withdrawal. That's why coming back feels so aversive. You're not just reloading information, you're overcoming a motivational deficit.
That explains something I've noticed but never had language for. When I'm interrupted mid-flow, I don't just forget what I was doing, I actively resent returning to it. The task that was engaging 30 seconds ago now feels repulsive.
That's the dopamine crash. And the fix isn't willpower. It's reducing the friction of re-entry to the point where the aversion doesn't have time to set in. If your state file is right there, and your context anchor is still playing, and you can resume in under 30 seconds, the motivational hit is much smaller. You're back in before your brain fully registers that it left.
The state file isn't just a memory aid. It's a motivational prosthetic.
That's exactly what it is. And this is why I keep coming back to the engineering frame. Every technique we're talking about is designed to make context switching cheaper. Not to eliminate it, you can't eliminate it with a baby in the house, but to reduce the per switch cost from 40 minutes to 5. If you can do that, 3 interruptions a day cost you 15 minutes instead of 2 hours. That's the difference between functional and drowning.
Let's get into some specific frameworks that already exist and can be adapted. The listener asked about organizational systems, and I know you've got opinions on GTD, getting things done.
GTD has a principle called next action that's useful here. The idea is that for any project or task, you always identify the very next physical action required, not work on the report. That's vague and requires your brain to do planning work before it can start doing actual work. Instead, open the Q2 data spreadsheet and add the revenue column. That specificity matters enormously when you're re-entering a task. If your state file says work on report, you come back and your brain has to figure out what that means. If it says add revenue column to Q2 spreadsheet, you can execute immediately.
Because you've offloaded the planning to your past self, who had full context.
Past you, who knew what was happening, did the thinking. Present you, who is frazzled and contextless, just executes. It's a gift from your past self to your future self.
There's also the 2-minute rule from GTD. If something takes less than 2 minutes, do it immediately rather than tracking it. But I wonder if that breaks down in an interruption-heavy environment. If you're getting interrupted every 10 minutes, do it now. Might mean you never get back to the main task.
That's a good critique. The 2-minute rule works when interruptions are occasional. When they're constant, you need a modified version. If it takes less than 2 minutes and it's related to your current sprint, do it. If it's unrelated, it goes in the parking lot.
The parking lot being?
A single notebook or digital note where you dump everything that's in your head when you're interrupted. Every half-formed thought, every, oh, I should remember to, every tangent your brain wants to chase. The rule is, nothing in the parking lot gets acted on during a sprint. It just gets captured. Your brain learns that it can let go of things because they're not lost. They're parked. This is particularly important for ADHD because the fear of forgetting is a major driver of internal interruption. Your brain interrupts itself because it's terrified the thought will evaporate.
Which it will.
Which it absolutely will. So you externalize the fear. The parking lot is a promise to your brain that nothing gets lost. You'll review it between sprints.
Let's talk about one more technique before we move to the practical implementation side. The don't break the chain method, adapted for this context. The original version is about doing something every day and marking it on a calendar. How does that work for sprints?
The adaptation is this. Instead of tracking did I do deep work today, which is binary and demoralizing when you fail, you track did I complete my scheduled sprints this week. If you scheduled 9 sprints across the week and you hit 6, that's not a failure, that's data. You now know that in your current life configuration, 6 sprints a week is realistic. Next week you aim for 7. The chain is about consistency, not perfection. And the visual feedback of seeing the chain build is motivating for ADHD brains. It's external dopamine.
You're not trying to be the person who never misses a sprint. You're trying to be the person who knows their actual capacity and gradually expands it.
And this connects to something I want to emphasize. The goal here is not to eliminate context switching. It's to make it cheaper. If you can reduce your average resumption cost from 35 minutes to 7, you've effectively created an extra hour of productive time per day without changing anything about your schedule or your childcare situation. That's not coping. That's an engineering win.
All right, let's shift to the practical question of how to actually implement this when you're already overwhelmed, because I think that's where a lot of advice falls apart. It assumes you have the executive function to set up the system in the first place.
This is the minimum viable system question. What's the absolute smallest thing you can do that still produces meaningful results? I think it's 3 things. 1, a single sticky note on your monitor. Left side, where you are. Right side, next action. That's it. You do that every time you stand up or hear the baby monitor. 2, 1 45-minute sprint per day, aligned with your medication peak. Not 3, not 2, 1. Prove to yourself that the system works before you scale it. 3, a parking lot. 1 notebook or 1 note on your phone. Everything goes there.
That's the onboarding ramp. You're not asking someone to overhaul their entire workflow. You're asking them to adopt 3 micro-habits that collectively reduce the cost of their biggest problem.
Once those 3 are stable, give it 2 weeks. You add the interruption protocol conversation with your partner. Then you add a second sprint. Then you experiment with context anchoring. You're building the system in layers, each layer making the next one easier because you're less cognitively depleted.
I want to talk about something the listener asked specifically. Who provides this kind of help? Because he's right that general therapists often aren't equipped for it. The clinical training model treats everything through a psychological lens, and if you present with overwhelm, they look for the emotional root cause rather than the structural one.
The field he's looking for is IDIHD coaching, specifically organizational skills coaching for neurodivergent professionals. This is distinct from therapy. Coaches don't diagnose or treat mental health conditions. They work on practical systems, time management, task initiation, environmental design, interruption management. The good ones understand the neuroscience but operate in the engineering domain.
There are actual organizations that credential these people.
The Attention Deficit Disorder Association. ADDA has a directory of ADHD coaches. CHADI, which is Children and Adults with Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, also maintains one. There's also a growing field called executive function coaching, which is even more pragmatic. It focuses specifically on the organizational skills that ADIHD undermines, planning, prioritization, working memory strategies, task initiation. Some of these coaches work remotely, which is relevant for the listener since he's an expat and might not have local options.
I'd also flag that some of the best ADHD coaching content is free. The YouTube channel, How to ADHD, has practical, systems-level content. The Translating ADHD podcast is run by two coaches who think in terms of mechanics, not therapy. Russell Barkley's work. He's a researcher, not a coach, but his framework for treating ADHD as a performance disorder rather than a knowledge disorder is foundational to this whole approach.
Barkley's key insight is that IDIHD isn't about not knowing what to do. It's about not doing what you know. The knowledge is there. The performance system is what's broken, so you don't need insight, you need scaffolding. External structures that do what your internal executive functions can't reliably do.
Which brings us back to the listener's frustration with therapy. Therapy often aims at insight. He doesn't need insight. He needs a git stash for his brain.
There are two books I want to recommend that operate in this exact space. One is Order from Chaos by Jacqueline Paul. It's specifically about organizational systems for ADHD adults, written by someone who has ADHD and lives the reality. The other is The ADHD Effect on Marriage by Melissa Orloff, which is relevant because the interruption protocol we described is fundamentally a partnership negotiation. When both partners understand the neurological cost of interruption, the conversation changes from "you're not helping enough" to "how do we design our interruption patterns to protect both of our cognitive resources?"
I also want to recommend something the listener can do starting tomorrow that costs nothing and requires no setup: time confetti mapping. For 1 week, every time you're interrupted, you jot down two things: what caused the interruption, and how many minutes it took you to fully re-engage. Not how long the interruption lasted, how long until you were back in the work.
This is powerful because it turns a vague sense of "I'm constantly interrupted" into data. And what you typically find is that 80% of your lost time comes from 20% of your interruption types. Maybe it's not the baby. Maybe the baby interruptions cost you 15 minutes total per day. Maybe it's your phone, or your own task drift, or the way you and your partner signal needs to each other. Once you have the data, you can target the expensive interruptions specifically, rather than trying to fix everything at once.
The act of tracking itself can be revealing. You might discover that what you thought was a 40-minute re-entry was actually 12 minutes, or that it was 90. The subjective experience of lost time is often wildly inaccurate. Data corrects the narrative.
There's a broader point here about the way we talk about ADHD and productivity. The dominant cultural narrative is that focus is a matter of discipline, that if you're struggling to context switch, you just need to try harder or want it more. That narrative is not just wrong, it's harmful. It takes a structural neurological limitation and reframes it as a moral failing. What we're describing here is the opposite approach. Acknowledge the structure, work with it, build systems that compensate for it. That's not weakness, that's engineering.
It's the difference between blaming the user and fixing the interface. If a piece of software crashes every time you try to switch tasks, you don't tell the user to switch more carefully. You fix the software. The state file, the sprints, the interruption protocol, the parking lot. These are all interface fixes.
I think there's a forward-looking dimension here, too. The listener is in an unusually intense season of life. 11-month-old, no childcare, no family support, two expats figuring it out alone. That season won't last forever. But the skills he's forced to develop right now, cheap context switching, externalized state management, ruthless prioritization, these are meta skills that will serve him for the rest of his career. As remote work and caregiving continue to blend, the ability to context switch efficiently is becoming a competitive advantage.
He's not falling behind. He's doing R&D on a problem most knowledge workers are going to hit in the next 5 years.
That's exactly the right reframe. The struggle is real, but it's also skill building. Every time he writes a state file note before attending to the baby, he's training a muscle that most professionals haven't even identified yet.
Let's pull this together into a concrete set of takeaways. If you're the listener, and you're exhausted, and you can barely brush your teeth, what's the Monday morning version of all this?
1. Build a resumption ritual. It's 30 seconds. When you're interrupted, you stand up, you say aloud what you were doing. Literally out loud, the auditory encoding helps, and you write one sentence about where you left off. That's it. The ritual does two things. It externalizes the state, and it creates a clean psychological boundary. You're not being ripped away from your work. You're deliberately saving and stepping away. That reframe alone reduces the dopamine crash.
2. Do the time confetti mapping for 1 week. You don't have to change anything. Just track every interruption and its resumption cost. At the end of the week, you'll know exactly which interruptions are eating your life. Maybe it's Slack. Maybe it's the baby monitor placement. Maybe it's your own brain's tendency to drift toward news sites at hour 3 of the medication window. Whatever it is, you can't fix what you can't measure.
3. Create a parking lot. Everything goes there. Half-formed thoughts, random ideas, things you need to remember, tasks that aren't part of the current sprint. When your brain says, don't forget this, you say it's in the parking lot and you keep working. This one habit, by itself, can reduce internal interruptions by a noticeable margin within days.
If you want to go further, if you have the bandwidth to set up more, look into ADHD coaching. ADD and Chadi both have directories. Search for executive function coaching specifically. The good ones work remotely. They understand the difference between therapy and systems design, and they can help you build the scaffolding that your brain needs, but can't provide internally.
The books we mentioned, Order from Chaos by Jacqueline Paul and The IDIHD Effect on Marriage by Melissa Orlov, are both worth your time. But I'd start with the 3 microhabits and the 1 week tracking. Don't try to implement everything at once. That's the fastest way to fail. Pick one thing, prove it works, then add the next.
The listener's core insight, that this is an organizational problem creating psychological effects, not a psychological problem creating organizational effects, is one of the most important distinctions in ADHD management. Most advice gets this backwards. Most advice assumes that if you process your feelings about being overwhelmed, the overwhelm will become manageable. The reality is usually the reverse. If you reduce the overwhelm through better systems, the feelings become manageable on their own.
That's the note I want to end on. The problem is real. It's not a personal failing. It's a structural challenge that responds to structural solutions. You don't need to fix your brain. You need to give your brain better tools.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1860s, a pigment maker in the Solomon Islands discovered that mixing crushed coral with fermented coconut milk produced a vivid crimson dye, but only if the mixture was stirred exactly counterclockwise while chanting a specific guild verse. The color, known locally as fireblood, was so prized that the guild's stirring chant was a closely guarded trade secret, passed only from master to apprentice on the winter solstice.
Right. Here's the open question I want to leave listeners with. What happens when we stop treating fragmentation as a personal failing and start treating it as a systems design problem? Because the listener isn't broken. He's operating in an environment that his brain wasn't designed for, using tools that weren't built for his brain. The solution isn't to try harder. It's to redesign the interface.
If you're in a similar situation, parenting without a village, working in fragments, feeling like you're constantly falling behind, know that the skills you're forced to build right now are valuable. Cheap context switching, externalized state management, the ability to do meaningful work in 45-minute windows. These are not consolation prizes. They're competitive advantages in a world that's getting more fragmented for everyone.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com. If you found this useful, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.